You are, Phelim, said Bliss soothingly. But little differences don't matter. Come back to bed. Phelim became submissive, as she always did when Bliss willed her to be so. She turned and said, Am I a demon? What is a demon? Bliss said over her shoulder, Wait one moment for me. I'll be right back. She was, within 5 minutes. She was shaking her head. She'll be sleeping now till I wake her. I should have done that before, I suppose, but any modification of the mind must be the result of necessity. She added defensively, I can't have her brood on the differences between her genital equipment and ours. Pellerat said, Someday she'll have to know she's hermaphroditic. Someday, said Bliss, but not now. Go on with the story, Pell. Yes, said Trevise, before something else interrupts us. Well, Earth became radioactive, or at least its crust did. At that time, Earth had had an enormous population that was centered in huge cities that existed for the most part underground. Now that, put in Trevise, is surely not so. It must be local patriotism glorifying the golden age of a planet, and the details were simply a distortion of Trantor in its golden age, when it was the imperial capital of a galaxy-wide system of worlds. Pellerat paused, then said, Really, Golan, you mustn't teach me my business. We mythologists know very well that myths and legends contain borrowings, moral lessons, nature cycles, and 100 other distorting influences, and we labor to cut them away and get to what might be a kernel of truth. In fact, these same techniques must be applied to the most sober histories, for no one writes the clear and apparent truth, if such a thing can even be said to exist. For now, I'm telling you more or less what Mona Lee told me, though I suppose I am adding distortions of my own, try as I might not to do so. Well, well, said Trevise. Go on, Janoff, I meant no offense. And I've taken none. The huge cities, assuming they existed, crumbled and shrank as the radioactivity slowly grew more intense, until the population was but a remnant of what it had been, clinging precariously to regions that were relatively radiation-free. The population was kept down by rigid birth control and by the euthanasia of people over 60. Horrible, said Bliss indignantly. Undoubtedly, said Pellerat. But that is what they did, according to Mona Lee, and that might be true, for it is certainly not complimentary to the Earth people, and it is not likely that an uncomplimentary lie would be made up. The Earth people, having been despised and oppressed by the Spacers, were now despised and oppressed by the Empire, though here we may have exaggeration there out of self-pity, which is a very seductive emotion. There is the case... Yes, yes, Pellerat, another time. Please go on with Earth. I beg your pardon. The Empire, in a fit of benevolence, agreed to substitute imported radiation-free soil and to cart away the contaminated soil. Needless to say, that was an enormous task which the Empire soon tired of, especially as this period, if my guess is right, coincided with the fall of Kandar V, after which the Empire had many more things to worry about than Earth. The radioactivity continued to grow more intense, the population continued to fall, and finally the Empire, in another fit of benevolence, offered to transplant the remnant of the population to a new world of their own, to this world, in short. At an earlier period, It seems an expedition had stocked the ocean, so that by the time the plans for the transplantation of Earth people were being developed, there was a full oxygen atmosphere and an ample supply of food on Alpha. Nor did any of the worlds of the Galactic Empire covet this world, because there is a certain natural antipathy to planets that circle stars of a binary system. There are so few suitable planets in such a system, I suppose, that even suitable ones are rejected because of the assumption that there must be something wrong with them. This is a common thought fashion. There is the well-known case, for instance, of... Later with the well-known case, Janoff, said Trevise. On with the transplantation. What remained, said Pellerat, hurrying his words a little, was to prepare a land base. The shallowest part of the ocean was found, and sediment was raised from deeper parts to add to the shallow sea bottom, and finally to produce the island of New Earth. Boulders and coral were dredged up and added to the island. Land plants were seeded so that root systems might help make the new land firm. Again, the Empire had set itself an enormous task. Perhaps continents were planned at first, but by the time this one island was produced, the Empire's moment of benevolence had passed. What was left of Earth's population was brought here. The Empire's fleets carried off its men and machinery, and they never returned. The Earth people, living on New Earth, found themselves in complete isolation. Trevise said, complete? Did Mona Lee say that no one from elsewhere in the galaxy has ever come here till we did? Almost complete, said Pellerat. There is nothing to come here for, I suppose, even if we set aside the superstitious distaste for binary systems. Occasionally, at long intervals, a ship would come, as ours did. But it would eventually leave, and there has never been a follow-up. And that's it. Trevise said, Did you ask Mona Lee where Earth was located? Of course I asked that. He didn't know. How can he know so much about Earth's history without knowing where it is located? I asked him specifically, Golan, if the star that was only a parsec or so distant from Alpha might be the sun about which Earth revolved. He didn't know what a parsec was, and I said it was a short distance, astronomically speaking. He said, short or long, he did not know where Earth was located, and he didn't know anyone who knew. And in his opinion, it was wrong to try to find it. It should be allowed, he said, to move endlessly through space in peace. Trevise said, Do you agree with him? Pellerat shook his head sorrowfully. Not really. But he said that at the rate the radioactivity continued to increase, the planet must have become totally uninhabitable not long after the transplantation took place, and that by now it must be burning intensely so that no one can approach. Nonsense, said Trevise firmly. A planet cannot become radioactive, and having done so, continuously increase in radioactivity. Radioactivity can only decrease. But Mona Lee is so sure of it. So many people we've talked to on various worlds unite in this, that Earth is radioactive. Surely it is useless to go on. 80. Trevise drew a deep breath, then said in a carefully controlled voice, Nonsense, Janoff. That's not true. Pellerat said, Well now, old chap, you mustn't believe something just because you want to believe it. My wants have nothing to do with it. In world after world, we find all records of Earth wiped out. Why should they be wiped out if there is nothing to hide? If Earth is a dead, radioactive world that cannot be approached. I don't know, Golan. Yes, you do. When we were approaching Melpomenia, you said that the radioactivity might be the other side of the coin. Destroy records to remove accurate information. Supply the tail of radioactivity to insert inaccurate information. Both would discourage any attempt to find Earth, and we mustn't be deluded into discouragement. Bliss said, Actually, you seem to think the nearby star is Earth's sun. Why then continue to argue the question of radioactivity? What does it matter? Why not simply go to the nearby star and see if it is Earth, and, if so, what it is like? Treviz said, Because those on Earth must be, in their way, extraordinarily powerful, and I would prefer to approach with some knowledge of the world and its inhabitants. As it is, since I continue to remain ignorant of Earth, approaching it is dangerous. It is my notion that I leave the rest of you here on Alpha, and that I proceed to Earth by myself. One life is quite enough to risk. No, Golan, said Pallarat earnestly. Bliss and the child might wait here, but I must go with you. I have been searching for Earth since before you were born, and I cannot stay behind when the goal is so close, whatever dangers might threaten. Bliss and the child will not wait here, said Bliss. I am Gaia, and Gaia can protect us, even against Earth. I hope you're right, said Treviz gloomily. But Gaia could not prevent the elimination of all early memories of Earth's role in its founding. That was done in Gaia's early history, when it was not yet well organized, not yet advanced. Matters are different now. I hope that is so. Or is it that you have gained information about Earth this morning that we don't have? I did ask that you speak to some of the older women that might be available here. And so I did. Treviz said, And what did you find out? Nothing about Earth. There is a total blank there. But they are advanced biotechnologists. Oh? On this small island, they have grown and tested innumerable strains of plants and animals, and designed a suitable ecological balance, stable and self-supporting, despite the few species with which they began. They have improved on the ocean life that they found when they arrived here a few thousand years ago, increasing their nutritive value and improving their taste. It is their biotechnology that has made this world such a cornucopia of plenty. They have plans for themselves, too. What kind of plans? Bliss said, They know perfectly well they cannot reasonably expect to expand their range under present circumstances, confined as they are to the one small patch of land that exists on their world. But they dream of becoming amphibious. Of becoming what? Amphibious. They plan to develop gills in addition to lungs. They dream of being able to spend substantial periods of time underwater, of finding shallow regions and building structures on the ocean bottom. My informant was quite glowing about it, but she admitted that this had been a goal of the Alphans for some centuries now, and that little, if any, progress had been made. Treviz said, That's two fields in which they might be more advanced than we are, weather control and biotechnology. I wonder what their techniques are. We'd have to find specialists, said Bliss, and they might not be willing to talk about it. Treviz said, It's not our primary concern here, but it would clearly pay the Foundation to attempt to learn from this miniature world. Pallarat said, We manage to control the weather fairly well on Terminus as it is. Control is good on many worlds, said Treviz. But always, it's a matter of the world as a whole. Here, the Alphans control the weather of a small portion of the world, and they must have techniques we don't have. Anything else, Bliss? Social invitations. These appear to be a holiday-making people, in whatever time they can take from farming and fishing. After dinner tonight, there'll be a music festival. I told you about that already. Tomorrow, during the day, there will be a beach festival. Apparently, all around the rim of the island, there will be a congregation of everyone who can get away from the fields, in order that they might enjoy the water and celebrate the sun, since it will be raining the next day. In the morning, the fishing fleet will come back, beating the rain, and by evening there will be a food festival, sampling the catch. Pellerat groaned. The meals are ample enough as it is. What would a food festival be like? I gather that it will feature not quantity, but variety. In any case, all four of us are invited to participate in all the festivals, especially the music festival tonight. On the antique instruments? Asked Treviz. That's right. What makes them antique, by the way? Primitive computers? No, that's the point. It isn't electronic music at all, but mechanical. They described it to me. They scrape strings, blow in tubes, and bang on surfaces. I hope you're making that up, said Treviz, appalled. No, I'm not. And I understand that your Hiroko will be blowing on one of the tubes. I forget its name. And you ought to be able to endure that. As for myself, said Pellerat, I would love to go. I know very little about primitive music, and I would like to hear it. She is not my Hiroko, said Treviz coldly. But are the instruments of the type once used on Earth, do you suppose? So I gathered, said Bliss. At least the Alphan women said they were designed long before their ancestors came here. In that case, said Treviz, it may be worth listening to all that scraping, tootling, and banging, for whatever information it might conceivably yield concerning Earth. 81. Oddly enough, it was Phelim who was most excited at the prospect of a musical evening. She and Bliss had bathed in the small outhouse behind their quarters. It had a bath with running water, hot and cold, or rather warm and cool, a washbowl and a commode. It was totally clean and usable, and in the late afternoon sun, it was even well-lit and cheerful. As always, Phelim was fascinated with Bliss's breasts, and Bliss was reduced to saying, now that Phelim understood Galactic, that on her world, that was the way people were. To which Phelim said, inevitably, why? And Bliss, after some thought, decided there was no sensible way of answering, returned the universal reply, because. When they were done, Bliss helped Phelim put on the undergarments supplied them by the Alphans, and worked out the system whereby the skirt went on over it. Leaving Phelim unclothed from the waist up seemed reasonable enough. She herself, while making use of Alphan garments below the waist, rather tight about the hips, put on her own blouse. It seemed silly to be too inhibited to expose breasts in a society where all women did, especially since her own were not large and were as shapely as any she had seen. But there it was. The two men took their turn at the outhouse next, Treviz muttering the usual male complaint concerning the time the women had taken. Bliss turned Phelim about to make sure the skirt would hold in place over her boyish hips and buttocks. She said, It's a very pretty skirt, Phelim. Do you like it? Phelim stared at it in a mirror and said, Yes, I do. Won't I be cold with nothing on, though? And she ran her hands down her bare chest. I don't think so, Phelim. It's quite warm on this world. You have something on? Yes, I do. That's how it is on my world. Now, Phelim, we're going to be with a great many Elfins during dinner and afterward. Do you think you can bear that? Phelim looked distressed, and Bliss went on. I will sit on your right side, and I will hold you. Pell will sit on the other side, and Trevise will sit across the table from you. We won't let anyone talk to you, and you won't have to talk to anyone. I'll try, Bliss, Phelim piped in her highest tones. Then afterward, said Bliss, some Elfins will make music for us in their own special way. Do you know what music is? She hummed in the best imitation of electronic harmony that she could. Phelim's face lit up.
You mean...
The last word was in her own language, and she burst into song. Bliss's eyes widened. It was a beautiful tune, even though it was wild and rich in trills. That's right. Music, she said. Phelim said excitedly,
Jembe made.
She hesitated, then decided to use the galactic word.
Music all the time. It made music on a...
Again a word in her own language. Bliss repeated the word doubtfully.
On a feeful?
Phelim laughed.
Not feeful.
With both words juxtaposed like that, Bliss could hear the difference, but she despaired of reproducing the second. She said,
What does it look like?
Phelim's as yet limited vocabulary in Galactic did not suffice for an accurate description, and her gestures did not produce any shape clearly in Bliss's mind.
He showed me how to use the...
Phelim said proudly.
I used my fingers just the way Jembe did, but it said that soon I wouldn't have to.
That's wonderful, dear, said Bliss. After dinner, we'll see if the Elfins are as good as your Jembe was. Phelim's eyes sparkled, and pleasant thoughts of what was to follow carried her through a lavish dinner, despite the crowds and laughter and noise all about her. Only once, when a dish was accidentally upset, setting off shrieks of excitement fairly close to them, did Phelim look frightened. And Bliss promptly held her close in a warm and protective hug.
I wonder if we can arrange to eat by ourselves, she muttered to Pellaret. Otherwise, we'll have to get off this world. It's bad enough eating all this isolate animal protein, but I must be able to do it in peace.
It's only high spirits, said Pellaret, who would have endured anything within reason that he felt came under the heading of primitive behavior and beliefs. And then the dinner was over, and the announcement came that the music festival would soon begin. 82. The hall in which the music festival was to be held was about as large as the dining room, and there were folding seats, rather uncomfortable, Trevise found out, for about 150 people. As honored guests, the visitors were led to the front row, and various Elfins commented politely and favorably on their clothes. Both men were bare above the waist, and Trevise tightened his abdominal muscles whenever he thought of it, and stared down on occasion with complacent self-admiration at his dark-haired chest. Pellaret, in his ardent observation of everything about him, was indifferent to his own appearance. Bliss's blouse drew covert stares of puzzlement, but nothing was said concerning it. Trevise noted that the hall was only about half full, and that the large majority of the audience were women, since presumably so many men were out to sea. Pellaret nudged Trevise and whispered, They have electricity. Trivius looked at the vertical tubes on the walls and at others on the ceiling. They were softly luminous.
Fluorescence, he said. Quite primitive.
Yes, but they do the job, and we've got those things in our rooms and in the outhouse. I thought they were just decorative. If we can find out how to work them, we won't have to stay in the dark.
Bliss said irritably, "They might have told us."
Pellerat said, "They thought we'd know, that anyone would know."
Four women now emerged from behind screens and seated themselves in a group in the space at the front. Each held an instrument of varnished wood of a similar shape, but one that was not easily describable. The instruments were chiefly different in size. One was quite small, two somewhat larger, and the fourth considerably larger. Each woman also held a long rod in the other hand. The audience whistled softly as they came in response to which the four women bowed. Each had a strip of gauze bound fairly tightly across the breasts, as though to keep them from interfering with the instrument.
Trevise, interpreting the whistles as signs of approval or of pleased anticipation, felt it only polite to add his own. At that, Phelim added a trill that was far more than a whistle, and that was beginning to attract attention when pressure from Bliss's hand stopped her. Three of the women, without preparation, put their instruments under their chins, while the largest of the instruments remained between the legs of the fourth woman and rested on the floor. The long rod in the right hand of each was sawed across the strings stretching nearly the length of the instrument, while the fingers of the left hand shifted rapidly along the upper ends of those strings. This, thought Trevise, was the scraping he had expected, but it didn't sound like scraping at all. There was a soft and melodious succession of notes, each instrument doing something of its own, and the whole fusing pleasantly. It lacked the infinite complexity of electronic music, real music, as Trevise could not help but think of it, and there was a distinct sameness to it. Still, as time passed, and his ear grew accustomed to this odd system of sound, he began to pick out subtleties. It was wearisome to have to do so, and he thought longingly of the clamor and mathematical precision and purity of the real thing. But it occurred to him that if he listened to the music of these simple wooden devices long enough, he might well grow to like it. It was not till the concert was some 45 minutes old that Hiroko stepped out. She noticed Trevise in the front row at once and smiled at him. He joined the audience in the soft whistle of approval with a whole heart. She looked beautiful in a long and most elaborate skirt, a large flower in her hair, and nothing at all over her breasts, since apparently there was no danger of their interference with the instrument. Her instrument proved to be a dark wooden tube about 2/3 of a meter long and nearly 2 centimeters thick. She lifted the instrument to her lips and blew across an opening near one end, producing a thin, sweet note that wavered in pitch as her fingers manipulated metal objects along the length of the tube. At the first sound, Phelim clutched at Bliss's arm and said, "Bliss, that's a..." And the words sounded like feeful to Bliss. Bliss shook her head firmly at Phelim, who said in a lower voice, "But it is." Others were looking in Phelim's direction. Bliss put her hand firmly over Phelim's mouth and leaned down to mutter an almost subliminally forceful, "Quiet," into her ear. Phelim listened to Hiroko's playing quietly thereafter, but her fingers moved spasmodically, as though they were operating the objects along the length of the instrument. The final player in the concert was an elderly man who had an instrument with fluted sides suspended over his shoulders. He pulled it in and out
while one hand flashed across a succession of white and dark objects at one end, pressing them down in groups. Trevise found the sound particularly wearing, rather barbaric, and unpleasantly like the memory of the barking of the dogs on Aurora. Not that the sound was like barking, but the emotions it gave rise to were similar. Bliss looked as though she would like to place her hands over her ears, and Pellerat had a frown on his face. Only Thallum seemed to enjoy it, for she was tapping her foot lightly. And Trevise, when he noticed that, realized to his own surprise that there was a beat to the music that matched Thallum's footfall. It came to an end at last, and there was a perfect storm of whistling, with Thallum's trill clearly heard above it all. Then the audience broke up into small conversational groups and became as loud and raucous as Alphans seemed to be on all public occasions. The various individuals who had played in the concert stood about in front of the room and spoke to those people who came up to congratulate them. Thallum evaded Bliss's grasp and ran up to Hiroko.
"Hiroko," she cried out gaspingly, "let me see the..."
"The what, dear one?" said Hiroko.
"The thing you made the music with."
"Oh," Hiroko laughed, "that's a flute, little one.
May I see it?"
"Well..." Hiroko opened a case and took out the instrument. It was in three parts, but she put it together quickly, held it toward Thallum with the mouthpiece near her lips, and said,
"There, blow thou thy breath across this." "I know, I know," said Thallum eagerly, and reached for the flute.
Automatically, Hiroko snatched it away and held it high.
"Blow, child, but touch not."
Thallum seemed disappointed.
"May I just look at it, then? I won't touch it."
"Certainly, dear one." She held out the flute again, and Thallum stared at it earnestly. And then the fluorescent lighting in the room dimmed very slightly, and the sound of a flute's note, a little uncertain and wavering, made itself heard. Hiroko, in surprise, nearly dropped the flute, and Thallum cried out,
"I did it! I did it! Jembe said someday I could do it."
Hiroko said, "Was it thou that made the sound?"
"Yes, I did. I did."
"But how didst thou do so, child?" Bliss said, red with embarrassment, "I'm sorry, Hiroko. I'll take her away."
"No," said Hiroko. "I wish her to do it again."
A few of the nearest Alphans had gathered to watch. Thallum furrowed her brow as though trying hard. The fluorescence dimmed rather more than before, and again there was the note of the flute, this time pure and steady. Then it became erratic as the metal objects along the length of the flute moved of their own accord.
"It's a little different from the..."
Thallum said a little breathlessly, as though the breath that had been activating the flute had been her own instead of power-driven air.
Pellerat said to Trevise, "She must be getting the energy from the electric current that feeds the fluorescence."
"Try again,"
said Hiroko in a choked voice. Thallum closed her eyes. The note was softer now and under firmer control. The flute played by itself, maneuvered by no fingers, but moved by distant energy, transduced through the still immature lobes of Thallum's brain. The notes, which began as almost random, settled into a musical succession. And now everyone in the hall had gathered around Hiroko and Thallum, as Hiroko held the flute gently with thumb and forefinger at either end, and Thallum, eyes closed, directed the current of air and the movement of the keys.
"It's the piece I played," whispered Hiroko. I remember it,
said Phelim, nodding her head slightly, trying not to break her concentration.
Thou didst not miss a note,
said Hiroko, when it was done.
But it's not right, Hiroko. You didn't do it right.
Bliss said, Phelim, that's not polite. You mustn't...
Please,
said Hiroko peremptorily, do not interfere.
Why is it not right, child? Because I would play it differently.
Show me, then. Again the flute played, but in more complicated fashion. For the forces that pushed the keys did so more quickly, in more rapid succession, and in more elaborate combinations than before. The music was more complex, and infinitely more emotional and moving. Hiroko stood rigid, and there was not a sound to be heard anywhere in the room. Even after Phelim had finished playing, there was not a sound, until Hiroko drew a deep breath and said,
Little one, hast thou ever played that before?
No, said Phelim. Before this, I could only use my fingers, and I can't do my fingers like that.
Then, simply and with no trace of vaunting,
No one can.
Canst thou play anything else?
I can make something up.
Dost thou mean improvise? Phelim frowned at the word and looked toward Bliss. Bliss nodded, and Phelim said,
Yes.
Please do so then, said Hiroko.
Phelim paused and thought for a minute or two, then began slowly, in a very simple succession of notes, the whole being rather dreamy. The fluorescent lights dimmed and brightened as the amount of power exerted intensified and faded. No one seemed to notice, for it seemed to be the effect of the music rather than the cause, as though a ghostly electrical spirit were obeying the dictates of the sound waves. The combination of notes then repeated itself a bit more loudly, then a bit more complexly, then in variations that, without ever losing the clearly heard basic combination, became more stirring and more exciting until it was almost impossible to breathe. And finally, it descended much more rapidly than it had ascended, and did so with the effect of a swooping dive that brought the listeners to ground level, while they still retained the feeling that they were high in the air. There followed sheer pandemonium that split the air, and even Trevise, who was used to a totally different kind of music, thought sadly, "And now I'll never hear that again." When a most reluctant quiet had returned, Hiroko held out her flute.
Here, Phelim, this is thine.
Phelim reached for it eagerly, but Bliss caught hold of the child's outstretched arm and said,
We can't take it, Hiroko. It's a valuable instrument.
I have another, Bliss. Not quite as good, but that is how it should be. This instrument belongeth to the person who playeth it best. Never have I heard such music, and it would be wrong for me to own an instrument I cannot use to full potential. Would that I knew how the instrument could be made to play without being touched.
Phelim took the flute, and with an expression of deep content, held it tightly to her chest. 83. Each of the two rooms of their quarters were lit by one fluorescent light. The outhouse had a third. The lights were dim and were uncomfortable to read by, but at least the rooms were no longer dark. Yet they now lingered outside. The sky was full of stars, something that was always fascinating to a native of Terminus, where the night sky was all but starless, and in which only the faint, foreshortened cloud of the galaxy was prominent. Hiroko had accompanied them back to their chambers for fear they would get lost in the dark, or that they would stumble. All the way back, she held Phalum's hand, and then, after lighting the fluorescents for them, remained outside with them, still clutching at the youngster. Bliss tried again, for it was clear to her that Hiroko was in a state of difficult conflict of emotions.
"Really, Hiroko, we cannot take your flute."
"No, Phalum must have it."
But she seemed on edge just the same. Travis continued to look at the sky. The night was truly dark, a darkness that was scarcely affected by the trickle of light from their own chambers, and much less so by the tiny sparks of other houses farther off. He said, "Hiroko, do you see that star that is so bright? What is it called?" Hiroko looked up casually and said, with no great appearance of interest,
"That's the companion."
"Why is it called that?"
"It circleth our sun every 80 standard years. It is an evening star at this time of year. Thou canst see it in the daytime, too, when it lieth above the horizon."
Good, thought Travis. She's not totally ignorant of astronomy. He said, "Do you know that Alpha has another companion, a very small, dim one that's much, much farther away than that bright star? You can't see it without a telescope." He hadn't seen it himself, hadn't bothered to search for it, but the ship's computer had the information in its memory banks. She said indifferently,
"We were told that in school."
"But now, what about that one? You see those six stars in a zigzag line?"
Hiroko said, "That is Cassiopeia."
"Really?" said Travis, startled. "Which star?"
"All of them. The whole zigzag. It is Cassiopeia."
"Why is it called that?"
"I lack the knowledge. I know nothing of astronomy, respected Travis."
"Do you see the lowermost star in the zigzag, the one that's brighter than the other stars? What is that?"
"It is a star. I know not its name."
"But except for the two companion stars, it's the closest of all the stars to Alpha. It is only a parsec away." Hiroko said,
"Sayest thou so? I know that not."
"Might it not be the star about which Earth revolves?" Hiroko looked at the star with a faint flash of interest.
"I know not. I have never heard any person say so."
"Don't you think it might be?"
"How can I say? None knoweth where Earth might be. I must leave thee now. I will be taking my shift in the fields tomorrow morning before the beach festival. I'll see you all there, right after lunch. Yes? Yes?"
"Certainly, Hiroko." She left suddenly, half running in the dark. Travis looked after her, then followed the others into the dimly lit cottage. He said, "Can you tell whether she was lying about Earth, Bliss?" Bliss shook her head.
"I don't think she was."